person who accompanies folks in the field. And so you can be a services operator without being a fishing guide, and vice versa, but you cannot book the trip if you are not a services operator. And I believe that's the reason here that there's a distinction between services and activities for which a guide license is required.
So just having a fishing guide license does not entitle you to take people out in your boat, is that right? Did you say you can't book?
Right. Mr. Chair, yes, Representative Brown, if you hold simply a fishing guide license, then you can accompany people in the field, but you cannot book the trip. You would then, and you'd be working for a services operator, taking their clients out in the field and getting paid for that activity.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown, to help maybe clarify a little bit, to go back to page 3. It lays out what on top of the page, line 1, is sport fishing service operator license. Now, that is a person that is, for example, a lodge owner that doesn't take guides out, but he wants to book trips. But he books them through, and then he has the guides that actually take people out. Now, there's quite a level when you get into this, but you've also, not only do you have the lodge operators, but you also have the single person, got his boat, that wants to do it. So he wants to book his own trips too. So he also falls in this thing, but he also can also have his own license as an operator, and also a license as a guide, so that he can go out, book his trips, and take the fishermen out himself. I think that's what they were trying to separate in the back a little bit.
Okay. I still don't think this language on line 27 is very clear.
I would agree, Representative Brown. I mean, as you're saying, a sport fish operator or the sport fish services person is the one that does the booking?
Yes. Service operator does the booking, but he doesn't necessarily need a fishing guide license to do the booking.
Correct. However, it does say sport fishing services does not include booking or other ancillary services provided by a tour broker. And what's the differentiation there?
I believe that was just so that you were getting away from just the booking agency themselves not being involved. I mean, the booking agency in Hoboken, New Jersey would be booking trips in Alaska. Is what you're trying to eliminate. What you want is your operators in Alaska actually making the decisions of who's going to send people out on the river, with guides.
Mr. Chairman?
Isn't that correct, Doug?
Mr. Chairman, it's Kevin. Right. I think maybe that's the best way to try to understand this. Is a booking, somebody who's simply a booking agent, maybe anywhere in the world. Someone who's a fishing guide is the person standing next to the client in the field for hire. In many cases in Alaska, what you still have in between those two layers is a sport fishing guiding business owner who provides for all the logistics, boats, the food in the field, the tents, the airplanes, whatever types of equipment are utilized, sets up the operation, either books directly with clients or through a booking agency, but they are the entity that sets up all the logistics and handles the field operations, but may not be the person that individually accompanies an angler in the field for hire. That would be the fishing guide. So you can build a lodge, buy the airplanes, get the food out there, the tents, and so on, without being a fishing guide. And because of that, you're not required to have all of the, meet all of the qualifications necessarily for the person that accompanies in the field. And I think that's, again, why the distinction here between the two.
If it's confusing, we're more than willing to redraft it to make it more clear, but do you understand what we're trying to do?
I think so. If you could then tell me how outfitters fit into this.
Representative Osmond, I'm going to shoot that.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brown, I believe, I'm sorry, I'm incorrect. The outfitters, we carefully drafted the definition so that any of the activities that led us into the debate over the outfitter category on the wildlife side are contained in total in the sport fishing services operator definition, so there's no ambiguity there whatsoever. You're doing the things that are normally attributed to outfitting. You are required to have a sport fishing services operator license.
Okay, then if I could ask again about line 27. A sport fishing service does not include an activity for which a guide license is required. It seems to me that we should remove that line because it does in fact involve an activity or include an activity for which a license is required, either by that operator or by one of his employees. Doesn't it? Or we're going to let these people go out and serve as outfit. I mean, it seems like it just totally defeat your purpose. If you know, sort of like the donut, but if you're missing the hole, if you don't actually get a guide, either yourself or your employees to be the guide.
Now, what that says is that as a, from page 3, your sport fishing service operator does not need to have a guide license to go on the river to fish. That's what that says.
But the service itself does include the activity for which a license is required, because you say right there on line 25 that you're providing those services through a person who's licensed as a fishing guide.
But as you're talking, he's already licensed either as a sport service operator.
Sport service operator is licensed. They can take someone out if themselves and do the fishing for compensation.
If they've also purchased or gotten your guide license.
See, Mr. Chairman, I think what's getting people confused is there are two separate functions.
So a sport fishing service operator cannot, with the sport fishing service operator license, take someone out on the river for compensation.
That's correct.
Only a fishing guide.
That's correct. So you're getting licensed, two different licenses. What they're doing is they're casting the widest net possible, under the theory that everyone who is benefiting from the resource should pay into that resource. So when you were simply going after the guide, you were going after a very small portion of the people who are benefiting. The larger portion, in fact, the people who really make the most money off of the service, are those who arrange the trips, who connect the consumer with the guide.
What's the travel agent?
Well, it can be.
And so they have to have a sport fish operator's license?
If a travel agency is connected directly to a guide, they can refer people just to a guide, but they're not getting commission off of it. They don't have to. It's only when they begin getting a commission and getting pay off of it.
Well, most of the travel agents, or a lot of them I know, do get referred to guides. Commission. I mean, that concerns me, I guess, in that it seems a little bit...
The way this was written, they would have to be dealing with the operators. They can't be dealing directly with the guides anymore.
Well, Mr. Chairman, like in Sitka, we have single boat individuals, and they here would have to have an operator's license in case somebody wrote them a letter or gave them a phone call, but then they'd have to have that guide license to actually take them out.
That's right.
And I assume the same would be with this boat if it's anchored at the dock, and people get off from a tow boat. They'd walk and say, can you take us out for 3 hours? I guess then only the guide license is required, unless they had arranged it, prepackaged it on board the vessel.
Now, the way this is set up, to operate as a guide, you have to operate under an operator.
A boat. Yeah.
So, but as a guide, you can't have an operator's license.
So if I'm an individual and I want to take, and I've got my six-pack license, and I want to go out and people fishing, I cannot just do that. If somebody walks up to me and says I want to go out, that's fine. If I want to have a travel agent, if I go out to all the travel agencies and say, I'll give you my normal commission, or you can have the normal commission that you get for this kind of thing, I have to then, I can't do that with just a guide license. I've got to actually get an operator's license.
If this bill passes, with your guide license, you will not be able to take customers out unless you've been booked through an operator. But you can be an operator for the same price as a guide. And that goes back to the fee structure. If you'll notice it, it's got A, B, and C on the fee structure on page 2. Fee structure gives you, for $75, you can have both your guide and your
I can be both. At which point I can directly contract.
Person can walk up to you and go. And that's where the majority of these small charter boat operators are going to be operating, particularly in the marine sector.
Mr. Chairman, I think the same would be true if a person had five or six Lund boats with 18 horse Johnsons on them or whatever it is. They could have people, they could then be classified as an outfitter, but they'd probably have to have an operator's license to book, wouldn't they?
They'd have to have the operator's license.
I mean, they're just outfitting with a, you know, here's the skiff, here's the motor, here's 6 gallons of gas, go.
That, I think,
I mean, that would be the outfitter.
I think that falls, yeah.
Does that fall under here?
Falls under the outfitters and the classification of the outfitter.
Yeah. Outfitter.
You can rent a boat. You can rent boats that not have to have an operator's license.
You don't have to have an operator license to rent a boat, just to rent a boat if you want to fish.
Well, if I had, like I said, if you had six boats, you could be renting them out, but not have to have a sport fish operator's license to do that. But if you're going to put a guide in with that boat to go out there, you better have an operator's license. The guide better have his guide license.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Mulder.
Unbelievable.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think one of the pivotal issues here is the question of insurance. The operator is the pivotal person in this relationship that is required to have insurance. Guides, generally speaking, do not have insurance to cover their clientele. It's the operator who carries the insurance. Consequently, travel agents aren't really considered operators because they don't carry insurance for their client, the clientele going fishing. It's the operator who's actually establishing that trip which goes out. Is that the way you read it also, Kevin?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulder, yes, that's correct.
My question is, give me the example of why we need an operator. Why don't we just make the requirements for insurance and everything else on the guide?
Mr. Chairman, because of your lodge operators who are not necessarily a guide, or you would be hiring guides.
You would take the insurance and make sure they had it.
Right.
But ultimately, it's the guide that's responsible for the, if they're on the river with the person. I mean, it seems like we're setting up two classes. I'm trying to figure out why we need an operator. I know there are going to be guides that work for other individuals. They may hire 5 or 6 guides or 10 guides to take people out. But and that guide has to have certain requirements for CPR, six-pack license. You know, obviously the guide has to have it if that's what it's required, and those kinds of things. So you're just saying the only things that are not required of the guide that are required of the operator are insurance?
The insurance part of it, Mr. Chairman, we talked about that quite a bit. The reason that you don't have every guide having the insurance is, like you just said, if you had 6 to 10 guides under your operation in the Woodchick area, for example, Would you require every one of your guides to go out and get insurance, or would you carry an umbrella through the operator? And that's what we're trying. You know, we do have two classifications here. You're correct. This is a two-tier system, and it's to reach that operator, that 10 guides, and then it's also to cover the individual operator guide.
Is insurance the only reason you have two categories? And that's what I'm trying to get at. Are there any other restrictions?
Yeah, the other reason is that a lot of these operators in the lodges particularly are not going to be guiding themselves.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
This is Kevin Delaney again. Another reason is that there's an effort here on the part of the industry and the department as well to make a separation between the owners of the guiding businesses and the individuals and company people in the field, because although in many cases those are one and the same, in many cases they are not. And one of the key pieces of this bill is the reporting requirement. And it was our belief, the department's belief, that by being able to hold the lodge owners accountable, carrying out any obligations regarding reporting, that we would have a much less difficult time sorting out estimates we may make, a harvest effort, distribution of that effort, number of clients. If I could use the example that Representative Osterman was was starting to make of a lodge in the Wood River system that may have a dozen clients at any one time, one owner, let's say four fishing guides. From our perspective, at the end of the season, or whenever, we don't want to be trying to chase down the four people who accompanied the anglers in the field all summer long, who may have turned over once or twice because they're college students or local folks that got done with some other job and went out and worked at the lodge for a few weeks. We want to be able to go to the services operator, collect the information that we need, and hold them accountable for that information. And frankly, we couldn't see any way from our experience with guiding that it would be successful chasing down all of the individuals who accompany people in the field. We feel like it's much more likely that we are going to be able to deal with the owners of the businesses. And that was our reason, more than anything else, for supporting the two-tiered system.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Martin, and then...
Yeah. One of the points that was brought up before from Mr. Delaney and maybe the sponsor, why is it that we want all these people to have insurance now? Just because it was in the law in the past to discontinue it?
Mr. Chairman? Yeah. Mr. Delaney here again. As I said, Representative Martin, as I said, there at the present time, there's a convergence of interests in this bill. And I believe that they come from the guiding industry, they come from the department, and they come from what I guess I characterize as other interested parties, other people involved in resource management and statecrafts. The guiding industry supported the insurance requirement because they felt that it would move their industry toward one that was more accountable, perhaps a higher quality experience, and also that there would be, trying to figure out a really good way to characterize this, but the people involved in the industry would actually be involved in the industry, and we wouldn't have large numbers of folks that just say they are and maybe go out once or twice and end up making it far more difficult for us to account for what's actually going on out there in the field.
Well, we have to have a public purpose for all these things, and outside of protection, turf protection, as I see right now, make it as costly as possible for these people who want to call themselves a sport fish guide. The $75 may be minor, but when you have an insurance, and you still didn't know, what are we insuring for? That they count properly? That they know CPR? What's the insurance for?
Liability insurance for injury, I suppose, if they get sued.
But isn't that their own private business matters?
Well, we require it in a lot of businesses as well, but...
Well, Nathan, as we said, the whole purpose here sounded so innocent and nice that we're going to help these guys help us collect information, vital, needed information. I guess we don't get at the mouth of the river how many fish are coming in. And now we're putting all these requirements on them, and it's just going to be that much more difficult, it seems like. What's the purpose? Get them to help us or make sure we have a new industry that's protected?
Mr. Chairman, the requirements that are in there, and I said there's basically three of them, that is the insurance, the CPR, first aid, and the U.S. Coast Guard license, are requirements that the industry themselves want to see. Matter of fact, as I said before, we can make a whole book out of this thing because of the things that people would like to see in this bill, including, you know, just everything from radio licenses on down. So, and I think the insurance was one of them that was came forward just about every time from the industry, that they wanted to see the sport fish charter boat industry to be above board and to have being perceived as a safe industry and that it's protected. Cruise ship that pulls in here and a person gets off and goes in an airplane, for example, the cruise ships are now requiring $1 million worth of insurance per seat to let their customers fly on airplanes around here. So the same thing's going to happen in this industry, if we don't show a face value to it or a protection.
Where did the $300,000 come from? Why isn't it?
I started with $500,000 and we brought it down to $300,000 after a few people complained.
Make it $1 billion.
I believe it's standard with the Kenai River requirement. And I think it runs about $700 a year for that level of coverage.
Who has, where is it required that you have insurance for the Kenai River?
It's under the Division of Parks and DNR.
So to get a permit to be able to guide on the Kenai River?
The Kenai, right.
Do you do that through regulation?
Correct.
Yeah. Chairman? And do they have the statutory authority to require insurance?
I believe so. They're requiring it.
So we don't need the
That's just on the Kenai River.
That was a special Kenai River management plan. We gave them that authority. It does not pertain to the rest of the state.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In Southeast Alaska, a operator guide has to have what we call a six-pack license. And only if that's the Coast Guard, and then they go right down before you get it, you have to show,
you have
the regulations operation going, including insurance and right on down the line. CPR and basic medical attention that you might expect.
But we have, and I agree, the six-pack license, though, I believe it's only on Coast Guard regulated waters. For instance, Kenai River or any inland lakes, I do not believe require a six-pack license.
And we cover that in here.
Only in,
that's why I said Southeast.
Yeah. Do you have any river raptors, though, or?
Yeah, there's some of that. Most of those are, the people run different types of things, so they already have their six-pack license, and then they take their run up to Keene, or
if they wouldn't have to at that point.
Mr. Chairman, in the inland waters, you still are required to get a license. It's not a six-pack. What's it called, Pat? Is it a six-pack license for running inland waters?
Okay. According to this, that doesn't include insurance.
People are floating down the Kenai with six people in their boat.
No, it's not motorized. There's a specific requirement in it. Also on page 4, in the line 1 and 2, where it talks about the Coast Guard license, if the person operates a vehicle or vessel in the provision of fishing guide services, and the license is required by the Coast Guard. So we've covered any area that is required by the Coast Guard.
Representative Kelly had a question, and Representative Brown.
I was making a point on something you were talking about. Why is there a difference between guide and a services person? If we've moved on from that, that's fine. Just to clarify something.
You were going to ask a question? Or
I was going to make a comment.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that the difference between the two is really not, you had made the comment that are we creating two classes here? I don't necessarily think that's the way to look at it. I think we are, through this legislation, accommodating two classes that exist that were created in a free market. And what you have between the services person and the guide is almost the same relation you have between a real estate broker and a real estate salesman. The broker carries all the insurance, the office supplies, and he's kind of the storefront guy, and the commission salesperson is almost, he's out there doing the field work. Senator Brown?
Thank you. I wanted to discuss Section 3 of the bill a little bit, which provides that the information in these reports shall be confidential. And I'm just wondering, why is that necessary?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brown, you take your saltwater operators, for example, that are doing halibut and salmon. A lot of them are very, very guarded on the areas that they take their clients to for fishing. I've seen it time and again being out trolling for king salmon that they won't talk about it. They don't want everybody to know what they're doing, how well they're doing, because you see time and again that one operator will be out there and he'll make a mistake and say how well he's doing, and then he'll have 15 boats around him fishing. Now, if he does that on a constant basis and his reports show that, then his particular fishing holes may get overcrowded. I think if you're just kind of trying to protect the operator himself and the type of business he's operating, have a little bit of confidentiality on his catch and where he's catching fish at.
Well, I guess I look at 370 and it doesn't say anything about location or the identification of particular operators. It's just talking about the number of these various species. And I'm just thinking, well, you know, I'm not sure how it is done with commercial fish, but I know there's some at least aggregate information that comes out as public information telling us what's going on in the commercial fishery, and I'm just saying that maybe this is a bit too broad here. If you look at the other things that are kept confidential now under 815D, they're all things where it's site specific, and we wouldn't want the denning sites or the nesting sites or something to be specifically identified in the public record, because then people could go there and overwhelm that resource and understand the reasons that those particular things are there. I just turn over to 370, and here you're just talking about numbers.
Mr. Chairman, in partial response to that, you almost have to be acquainted with the resource at that point in time to understand it, that people kind of know where other guides fish at, you know, and but they don't know how successful they are. In fact, it's kind of a joke about the fact, well, how well did you do? Oh, we got one or two. You know, there's not a whole lot of truth in relation to day-to-day conversation, but within these reports, there would be truth, well-grounded truth. So you know where your counterparts are fishing at, you just don't know how well they're fishing or how good they're fishing.
But perhaps we could tailor this more carefully so that the department could release aggregate data by river or something. I mean, if the point is to have resource management data, why only do we want the Department of Fish and Game to be able to see it? I mean, it seems like you could still protect locations and who was doing what where and provide valuable information for the public process if we... You see, this doesn't even say that they shall collect anything other than the number that I see here.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Delaney?
Yes, Mr. Delaney. Representative Brown, that's an excellent question. As I'm reading this, I'm wondering whether or not what we've done here got started on something we should add a little bit more to, as you said. In the commercial fishing side, we cannot report the catch by any permit holder, but there is an aggregate. And it depends a little bit on the number of total people there, but it's oftentimes a half a dozen or so. In this instance, if in fact, upon reading this, this would prevent us from reporting on that information in any, back to you for in an open report or the Board of Fisheries, and I think we ought to take a close look at it. And if in fact you're looking for some language that would allow us to do that in the manner that we most often do it, it wouldn't be on a river-by-river, it would be on a fishery-by-fishery basis. I would want to be certain that this didn't prevent us from reporting on the guided harvest effort, distribution of effort, and whatnot on a fishery-by-fishery basis. So thank you very much. That was an excellent question.
Could we say on page 2, line 3, if we could clarify what information it is that's to be kept confidential? In other words, I want to say client-specific, but these people aren't clients, but licensee-specific data from licensees or information contained in the reports, except not aggregated data, or just something to indicate that as long as they're not identifying who it is, you know, if they're putting together all the people's catch in this particular area, I don't see why that would be harmful to any particular operator. And I think it should be, like you said, they need the ability to do that. This, the way it's written now, mandates that they keep confidential the numbers of how many of these species are taken.
Mr. Delaney, on the, do you have any corresponding thing? In other words, there are some fisheries where there is one guide on a river, and it would be very easy if you released either river or areas, that it would be pretty easy to tell an individual. And don't you have similar circumstances where in other fisheries, whether commercial or otherwise, I mean, you have language that you could suggest that would protect? I think you understand what we're trying to do as well. I mean, so that you can release information, but that in certain circumstances it may clearly identify one operator or guide and how well they're doing, and that's not necessarily the intent.
Right. Mr. Chairman, I understand the intent here, and I've got it. Doug with me, we're going through the language. I'm trying to find that language that exists for the commercial fishery. I'm not certain we'll be able to find it right now. We do have some instances, as you say, where there are one or very few operators in a river. Very often, we look at that, a larger area perhaps, when we think of a fishery. So that was one of the reasons that I used that term. But it's something that we manage as a unit, like a fishery, there's very seldom just one potentially affected operator in that area. I certainly get the drift of what you're trying to do, and I support it entirely. I don't know how you want me to handle this. We can work on some language for a potential amendment here quickly, or
Here's what I'd like to do is have you work on that. We'll go through any other questions, but bring it up first thing in the morning, because we have scheduled these for, just like we have the other bill, and see if we can get the language. Rather than try and do it verbally, if you can do that, work with the legal department as well to make sure it's drafted correctly. Have something for us by 8 o'clock tomorrow morning on that, so that we can take care of that problem.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Kevin, you might also look at the commercial fish management areas somehow that might be able to tie it in.
Okay, we'll do that. Thank you.
Representative Brown?
Thank you. Does this bill affect subsistence fishing in any manner?
No.
Does this bill in any manner limit who can get one of these licenses or become an operator?
No, only other than what is required under the definition.
But it's not intended to say you have to be doing this today. It's no. Still open to anyone that would want
right.
to start a
this
business.
Is not, this
in
is
the
not
future.
A limited entry machine.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Kevin, while you're online, looking at the fiscal note, I noticed that it's anticipated that this is going to create a half-time for an admin clerk, one, a full-time fisheries biologist, two, a fisheries biologist, one, and a six-month accounting clerk, three. Is it necessary for all those functions? I think, do we have to utilize all new positions? There's no way we can incorporate some, the information, some of that information to be utilized by existing personnel? Seems like we're expending all the money just in terms of person that we're gaining just in personal services with the collection.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulder, that's a good question. On the accounting clerk, what we've got there, of course, is we're going to just need to beef up our licensing effort to take care of this. And that piece, and I think that piece is unavoidable under any circumstances. The licensing program is operating at capacity right now. The fisheries staff here, the full-time biologist and the seasonal biologist, are needed to deal with the anticipated information that comes back through the reporting requirements. And under the
Kevin, to that point, I mean, those are the two positions that trouble me the most. I understand the collection and dissemination of the information in relation to the board, but why do we need two new biologists? Are you saying that we're not doing what's not being done now? Are the folks within the department not able to handle the information that you're receiving now?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulder, we're able to deal, well, of course, right now what we have is we're 1 year into statewide registration, and the registration procedure that we have right now does not come with a mandatory reporting requirement at all. And so, again, focusing on the mandatory reporting requirement, the reason that we have two positions there is, one, we have a mandatory reporting requirement, and two, that reporting requirement is we are instructed to carry that out in season. And so what we anticipate to comply with that is an individual that's dealing full-time with the flow of information that comes back from the 2,000 to 3,000 or so operators around the state on an in-season basis.
Do you want, Mr. Chairman, before we go on, do you want to talk about the amendments that I have proposed that may, in fact, help with that?
Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Yeah, a question to Kevin. I understood the last conversation we had, Kevin, was that you were going to look at logbooks or something like that that would be done at the and then compiled at the end of the season.
Chairman, Representative Osterman, what we anticipate here to comply with the language of this is at the very least a system as you describe, and that is to issue logbooks to our services operators that we would require them to keep this log current through the season. And then our anticipation would be to collect those logbooks post-season and then analyze that information. Now, in certain areas of the state, I'm certain, and these are areas where we I don't want to get into a long discussion about logbooks here, because there are probably very good reasons for having them, and there are very good reasons as well to question some of the information that you get from them. And in areas of the state where we currently have in-season monitoring methodology in place, such as the creel census in southeast Alaska and the Kenai River, those are excellent examples. There are instances where when we compile our logbook information, I'm sure we're going to have discrepancies, and that's going to lead us to want to sort those discrepancies out, because it's not a very comfortable fishery manager that has two estimates of either harvest or effort. And so some of those, chasing after some of those questions, sorting that out is why we foresee the need for two biologist positions, one that would be seasonal.
Kevin, does the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council consider the information in logbooks verifiable?
This is Doug McClain, Alaska Department of Fish and Game. They consider them verifiable, however, they have extensive programs to verify the information. That is, unless there's some type of observer program on place or some other program to verify the information recorded, they really do not implement the program very often. Same thing with the halibut
commission. Okay. And the reason I bring the question up, Kevin, one of the amendments I have proposed would address the question of in-season on page 5, line 5. Actually, I believe it's, it is line 5. Talks about collect in-season information, which are, I assume, are the log books that you're referring to. And I delete the reference to in-season, so thereby deleting the requirement of the in-season log books. What's your opinion on that amendment?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulder, I wouldn't have any trouble with that amendment. Where we have the requirement for in-season information, we will collect it in-season, and because it's a mandatory reporting requirement now, whatever reason to believe that we get it. We still need to sort out whether that was a better estimate than the ones we're currently obtaining. Of course, there are many areas of the state where, at the present time, we don't have in-season monitoring programs in place, and so this might be the only information we have there. And in that case, we'd want it in-season. Through the discussions leading to the development of this language, we've, on a number of occasions, stated our concern of being obligated to a harvest effort reporting mechanism that may or may not be necessary. We wouldn't want to leave anybody with the feeling coming out of here that they could walk in July and say, how many fish have guided anglers taken in the Togiak River so far this year? That's not the kind of system that we envision having in place, or in the fiscal note would be much, much larger. I would be fine with that amendment. We would be doing it still where we felt it was necessary, and we wouldn't be obligated to do it in those cases where it might not prove cost-effective or where the estimates might not be valid.
Okay. But it doesn't, by doing that, we're not going to diminish the fiscal note at all?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulder, I don't believe we would substantially. I wouldn't want to promise that we would at the present time, because, again, as I said, as we get into analyzing these data, like any other fisheries data, I really wouldn't want to leave us short of the personnel to do that at this time.
Well, Kevin, one of the things that bothers me when I look at the fiscal note, I notice that the program's going to cost us, we have revenues of about $181,000, and yet the program's going to cost us $234,000. And it was not my desire to have this program funded out of the general fund, but it'd be driven by users, program receipts. And that inconsistency is troublesome to me.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulder, Doug, who's worked with, who would potentially be implementing this program, feels, and I concur, that the seasonal biologist time could be reduced somewhat, perhaps cut in half, by not being obligated to an in-season information system statewide from the get-go here.
So you would feel that we could diminish?
That would achieve your objective of making it revenue neutral. And I don't believe going into it, that Representative Mulder, that we necessarily can do a good job and have it be a revenue neutral situation. I would point out that the fees collected here go into the Fish and Game Fund, and that the non-resident contribution to that fund as it is upwards to about 80%, and those are the clients of a lot of the guides. And one of the things that the guides have pointed out is that specifically, and that, you know, to a large extent, they're paying a lot of the cost of their business as well, but the things that we have been required to do to support the guiding industry and to compile information on the guiding industry and provide that information, whether it be at the North Pacific Management Council and the legislature and the Board of Fisheries, has I think markedly increased the cost of doing business for us with respect to the guiding industry. Revenue neutral would be fine, but if we can keep it as close to that as possible, yet not that, I think we've still got a real important program here that should go forward.
Any other questions at this point? Like I said, well, Mr. Delaney, if you could come up with that language on the confidentiality for tomorrow morning, and we'll take up the amendments that are before us as well first thing in the morning. And any other questions for Mr. Delaney or anyone else at this point? If not, we do have session at 5, and I've got a few things I have to do between now and then as well. So we'll wrap up for today. So tomorrow morning we'll start off with this bill. We'll go to the regulation bill right after that. And then in the afternoon, we've got the bills lifted that are scheduled. So we'll go from there. So we'll adjourn for today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning. We have that language looked at.